Our section of the street only ran one way. My parked car was facing in the proper direction. The police car had come down the street in the wrong direction. I noticed for the first time that it wasn't an ordinary police cruiser, but one of the special Atlanta SWAT cars. The officers had a spotlight attached to their vehicle, and they directed it at me sitting in my car. Only then did it occur to me that they might be there for me, but I couldn't imagine why. I had been parked on the street for about 15 minutes listening to Sly. Only one of my car speakers worked, and not very well. I knew the music couldn't be heard outside the car. The officers sat there with their light pointed at me for a minute or so. I turned off the radio before stand was over. I had case files on my car seat about Loretta Ruffin and the young man who had been shot in Gadsden. Eventually, two police officers got out of their vehicle. I noticed immediately that they weren't wearing the standard Atlanta police uniform. Instead, they were ominously dressed in military-style black boots with black pants and vests. I decided to get out of my car and go home. Even though they were intensely staring at me in my car, I was still hoping that they were in the area for something unrelated to me. Or if they were concerned that something was wrong with me, I figured I would let them know that everything was okay. It certainly never occurred to me that getting out of my car was wrong or dangerous. As soon as I opened my car door and got out, the police officer who had started walking toward my vehicle drew his weapon and pointed it at me. I must have looked completely bewildered. My first instinct was to run. I quickly decided that wouldn't be smart. Then I thought for an instant that maybe these weren't real police officers. "Move and I'll blow your head off!" The officer shouted the words, but I couldn't make any sense of what he meant. I tried to stay calm. It was the first time in my life anyone had ever pointed a gun at me. "Put your hands up!" The officer was a white man about my height. In the darkness, I could only make out his black uniform and his pointed weapon. I put my hands up and noticed that he seemed nervous. I don't remember deciding to speak. I just remember the words coming out. "It's all right. It's okay." I'm sure I sounded afraid because I was terrified. I kept saying the words over and over again. "It's okay. It's okay." Finally, I said, "I live here. This is my apartment." I looked at the officer who was pointing the gun at my head less than 15 feet away. I thought I saw his hand shaking. I kept saying as calmly as I could, "It's okay. It's okay." The second officer, who had not drawn his weapon, inched cautiously toward me. He stepped on the sidewalk, circled behind my parked car, and came up behind me while the other officer continued to point the gun at me. He grabbed me by the arms and pushed me up against the back of my car. The other officer then lowered his weapon. "What are you doing out here?" said the second officer, who seemed older than the one who had drawn his weapon. He sounded angry. "I live here. I moved into that house down the street just a few months ago. My roommate is inside. You can go ask him." I hated how afraid I sounded and the way my voice was shaking. "What are you doing out in the street?"
"I was just listening to the radio."
He placed my hands on the car and bent me over the back of the vehicle. The SWAT car's bright spotlight was still focused on me. I noticed people up the block turning on their lights and peering out their front doors. The house next to ours came to life, and a middle-aged white man and woman walked outside and stared at me as I was leaned over the vehicle. The officer holding me asked me for my driver's license, but wouldn't let me move my arms to retrieve it. I told him that it was in my back pocket, and he fished my wallet out from my pants. The other officer was now leaning inside my car and going through my papers. I knew that he had no probable cause to enter my vehicle and that he was conducting an illegal search. I was about to say something when I saw him open the glove compartment. Opening objects in a parked vehicle was so incredibly illegal that I realized he wasn't paying any attention to the rules, so saying something about it would be pointless. There was nothing interesting in my car. There were no drugs, no alcohol, not even tobacco. I kept a giant-sized bag of peanut M&Ms and bazooka bubblegum in the glove compartment to help stave off hunger when I didn't have time for a meal. There were just a few M&Ms left in the bag, which the officer inspected carefully.
He put his nose into the bag before tossing it back. I wouldn't be eating those M&Ms. I had not lived at our new address long enough to get a new driver's license, so the address on my license didn't match the new location. There was no legal requirement to update the driver's license, but it prompted the officer to hold me there for another 10 minutes while he went back to his car to run a search on me. My neighbors grew bolder as the encounter dragged on. Even though it was late, people were coming out of their homes to watch. I could hear them talking about all the burglaries in the neighborhood. There was a particularly vocal older white woman who loudly demanded that I be questioned about items she was missing. "Ask him about my radio and my vacuum cleaner." Another lady asked about her cat, who had been absent for 3 days. I kept waiting for my apartment light to come on and for Charlie to walk outside and help me out. He had been dating a woman who also worked at Legal Aid and had been spending a lot of time at her house. It occurred to me that he might not be home. Finally, the officer returned and spoke to his partner. "They don't have anything on him." He sounded disappointed. I found my nerve and took my hands off the car. "This is so messed up. I live here. You shouldn't have done this. Why did you do this?" The older officer frowned at me. "Someone called about a suspected burglar. There have been a lot of burglaries in this neighborhood." Then he grinned. "We're going to let you go. You should be happy," he said. With that, they walked away, got in their SWAT car, and drove off. The neighbors looked me over one last time before retreating back into their homes. I couldn't decide whether I should race to my door so that they could see that I lived in the neighborhood, or wait until they were all gone so that no one would know where the suspected criminal lived. I decided to wait. I gathered up my papers, which the cop had scattered all over the car and onto the sidewalk. I unhappily threw my M&Ms into a trash can on the street and then walked into my apartment. To my great relief, Charlie was there. I woke him to tell the story. "They never even apologized," I kept saying. Charlie shared my outrage but soon fell back asleep. I couldn't sleep at all. The next morning, I told Steve about the incident. He was furious and urged me to file a complaint with the Atlanta Police Department. Some folks in the office said I should explain in my complaint that I was a civil rights attorney working on police misconduct cases. It seemed to me that no one should need those kinds of credentials to complain about misconduct by police officers. I started writing my complaint determined not to reveal that I was an attorney. When I replayed the whole incident in my mind, what bothered me most was the moment when the officer drew his weapon and I thought about running. I was a 28-year-old lawyer who had worked on police misconduct cases. I had the judgment to speak calmly to the officer when he threatened to shoot me. When I thought about what I would have done when I was 16 years old, or 19, or even 24, I was scared to realize that I might have run. The more I thought about it, the more concerned I became about all the young black boys and men in that neighborhood. Did they know not to run? Did they know to stay calm and say, "It's okay"? I detailed all of my concerns. I found Bureau of Justice statistics reporting that black men were 8 times more likely to be killed by the police than whites. By the end of the 20th century, the rate of police shootings would improve so that men of color were only 4 times more likely to be killed by law enforcement. But the problem would get worse as some states passed Stand Your Ground laws, empowering armed citizens to use lethal force as well. I kept writing my memo to the Atlanta Police Department, and before I knew it, I had typed close to 9 pages outlining all the things I thought had gone wrong. For 2 pages, I detailed the completely illegal search of the vehicle and the absence of probable cause. I even cited about 6 cases. I read over the complaint and realized that I had done everything but say, "I'm a lawyer." I filed my complaint with the police department and tried to forget about the incident, but I couldn't. I kept thinking about what had happened. I began to feel embarrassed that I hadn't asserted more control during the encounter. I hadn't told the officers I was a lawyer, or informed them that what they were doing was illegal. Should I have said more to them? Despite the work I'd done assisting people on death row, I questioned how prepared I was to do really difficult things. I even started having second thoughts about going to Alabama to start a law office. I couldn't stop thinking about how at risk young kids are when they get stopped by the police. My complaint made it through the review process at the Atlanta Police Department. Every few weeks, I'd get a letter explaining that the police officers had done nothing wrong and that police work is very difficult. I appealed these dismissals unsuccessfully up the chain of command. Finally, I requested a meeting with the chief of police and the police officers who had stopped me. This request was denied, but the deputy chief met with me. I had asked for an apology and suggested training to prevent similar incidents. The deputy chief nodded politely as I explained what had happened. When I finished, he apologized to me, but I suspected that he just wanted me to leave. He promised that the officers would be required to do some extra homework on community relations. I didn't feel vindicated. My caseload was getting crazy. The lawyers defending the Gadsden City Jail finally acknowledged that Mr. Ruffin's rights had been violated and that he had been illegally denied his asthma medicine. We want a decent settlement for Mr. Ruffin's family, so they would at least receive some financial help. I turned the other police misconduct cases over to other lawyers because my death penalty docket was so full. I had no time to make war with the Atlanta police when I had clients facing execution. Still, I couldn't stop thinking about how dangerous and unfair the situation was, and how I'd done nothing wrong. And what if I had had drugs in my car? I would have been arrested, and then would have needed to convince my attorney to believe me when I explained that the police had entered the car illegally. Would I get an attorney who would take such a claim seriously? Would a judge believe that I'd done nothing wrong? Would they believe someone who was just like me but happened not to be a lawyer? Someone like me who was unemployed or had a prior criminal record? I decided to talk to youth groups, churches, and community organizations about the challenges posed by the presumption of guilt assigned to the poor and people of color. I spoke at local meetings and tried to sensitize people to the need to insist on accountability from law enforcement. I argued that police could improve public safety without abusing people. Even when I was in Alabama, I made time for talks at community events whenever anyone asked. I was in a poor rural county in Alabama after another trip to pull records in a death penalty case when I was invited to speak at a small African-American church. Only about 24 people showed up. One of the community leaders introduced me, and I went to the front of the church and began my talk about the death penalty, increasing incarceration rates, abuse of power within prisons, discriminatory law enforcement, and the need for reform. At one point, I decided to talk about my encounter with the police in Atlanta, and I realized that I was getting a bit emotional. My voice got shaky, and I had to rein myself in to finish my remarks. During the talk, I noticed an older black man in a wheelchair who had come in just before the program started. He was in his 70s and wearing an old brown suit. His gray hair was cut short with unruly tufts here and there. He looked at me intensely throughout my presentation, but showed no emotion or reaction during most of the talk. His focused stare was unnerving. A young boy who was about 12 had wheeled him into the church, probably his grandson or a relative. I noticed that the man occasionally directed the boy to fetch things for him. He would wordlessly nod his head, and the boy seemed to know that the man wanted a fan or a hymnal. After I finished speaking, the group sang a hymn to end the session. The older man didn't sing, but simply closed his eyes and sat back in his chair. After the program, people came up to me. Most folks were very kind and expressed appreciation for my having taken the time to come and talk to them. Several young black boys walked up to shake my hand. I was pleased that people seemed to value the information I shared. The man in the wheelchair was waiting in the back of the church. He was still staring at me. When everyone else had left, he nodded to the young boy who quickly wheeled him up to me. The man's expression never changed as he approached me. He stopped in front of me, leaned forward in his wheelchair, and said forcefully, "Do you know what you're doing?" He looked very serious and he wasn't smiling. His question threw me. I couldn't tell what he was really asking or whether he was being hostile. I didn't know what to say. He then wagged his finger at me and asked again, "Do you know what you're doing?" I tried to smile to defuse the situation, but I was completely baffled. "I think so." He cut me off and said loudly, "I'll tell you what you're doing. You're beating the drum for justice." He had an impassioned look on his face. He said it again emphatically. "You've got to beat the drum for justice." He leaned back in his chair and I stopped smiling. Something about what he said had sobered me. I answered him softly, "Yes, sir." He leaned forward again and said hoarsely, "You've got to keep beating the drum for justice." He gestured and after a long while said again, "Beat the drum for justice." He leaned back, and in an instant he seemed tired and out of breath. He looked at me sympathetically and waved me closer. I did so, and he pulled me by the arm and leaned forward. He spoke very quietly, almost a whisper, but with a fierceness that was unforgettable. "You see this scar on the top of my head?" He tilted his head to show me. "I got that scar in Greene County, Alabama, trying to register to vote in 1964. You see this scar on the side of my head?" He turned his head to the left, and I saw a 4-inch scar just above his right ear. "I got that scar in Mississippi demanding civil rights." His voice grew stronger. He tightened his grip on my arm and lowered his head some more. "You see that mark?" There was a dark circle at the base of his skull. "I got that bruise in Birmingham after the Children's Crusade." He leaned back and looked at me intensely. "People think these are my scars, cuts, and bruises." For the first time, I noticed that his eyes were wet with tears. He placed his hands on his head. "These aren't my scars, cuts, and bruises. These are my medals of honor." He stared at me for a long moment, wiped his eyes, and nodded to the boy who wheeled him away. I stood there with a lump in my throat, staring after him. After a moment, I realized that the time to open the Alabama office had come. Chapter 3. Trials and Tribulation. After months of frustration, failure, and growing public scorn, Sheriff Thomas Tate, ABI lead investigator Simon Benson, and the district attorney's investigator Larry Eichner decided to arrest Walter McMillan based primarily on Ralph Meyer's allegation. They hadn't yet done much investigation into McMillan, so they decided to arrest him on a pretextual charge while they built their case. Meyers claimed to be terrified of McMillan. One of the officers suggested to Meyers that McMillan might have sexually assaulted him. The idea was so provocative and inflammatory that Meyers immediately recognized its usefulness and somberly acknowledged that it was true. Alabama law had outlawed non-procreative sex, so officials planned to arrest McMillan on sodomy charges. On June 7, 1987, Sheriff Tate led an army of more than a dozen officers to a backcountry road that they knew Walter would use on his return home from work. Officers stopped Walter's truck and drew their weapons, then forced Walter from his vehicle and surrounded him. Tate told him he was under arrest. When Walter frantically asked the sheriff what he had done, the sheriff told him that he was being charged with sodomy. Confused by the term, Walter told the sheriff that he did not understand the meaning of the word. When the sheriff explained the charge in crude terms, Walter was incredulous and couldn't help but laugh at the notion. This provoked Tate, who unleashed a torrent of racial slurs and threats. Walter would report for years that all he heard throughout his arrest over and over again was the word nigger. Nigger this, nigger that, followed by insults and threats of lynching. "We're going to keep all you niggers from running around with these white girls. I ought to take you off and hang you like we done that nigger in Mobile," Tate reportedly told Walter. The sheriff was referring to the lynching of a young African-American man named Michael Donald in Mobile, about 60 miles south. Donald was walking home from the store one evening, hours after a mistrial was declared in the prosecution of a black man accused of shooting a white police officer. Many white people were shocked by the verdict and blamed the mistrial on the African-Americans who had been permitted to serve on the jury. After burning a cross on the courthouse lawn, a group of enraged white men who were members of the Ku Klux Klan went out searching for someone to victimize. They found Donald as he was walking home and descended on him. After severely beating the young black man, they hanged him from a nearby tree, where his lifeless body was discovered several hours later. Local police ignored the obvious evidence that the death was a hate crime and hypothesized that Donald must have been involved in drug dealing, which his mother adamantly denied. Outraged by the lack of local law enforcement interest in the case, the black community and civil rights activists persuaded the United States Department of Justice to get involved. Three white men were arrested 2 years later, and details of the lynching were finally made public. It had been more than 3 years since the arrests, but when Tate and the other officers started making threats of lynching, Walter was terrified. He was also confused. They said he was being arrested for raping another man, but they were throwing questions at him about the murder of Rhonda Morrison. Walter vehemently denied both allegations. When it became clear that the officers would get no help from Walter in making a case against him, they locked him up and proceeded with their investigation. When Monroe County District Attorney Ted Pearson first heard his investigators' evidence against Walter McMillan, he must have been disappointed. Ralph Myers' story of the crime was pretty far-fetched. His knack for dramatic embellishment made even the most basic allegations unnecessarily complicated. Here's Myers' account of the murder of Rhonda Morrison. On the day of the murder, Myers was getting gas when Walter McMillan saw him at the gas station and forced him at gunpoint to get in Walter's truck and drive to Monroeville. Myers didn't really know Walter before that day. Once in the truck, Walter told Myers he needed him to drive because Walter's arm was hurt. Myers protested but had no choice. Walter directed Myers to drive him to Jackson Cleaners in downtown Monroeville and instructed him to wait in the truck while McMillan went inside alone. After waiting a long time, Myers drove down the street to a grocery store to buy cigarettes. He returned 10 minutes later. After another long wait, Myers finally saw McMillan emerge from the store and return to the truck. Upon entering the truck, he admitted that he had killed the store clerk. Myers then drove McMillan back to the gas station so that Myers could retrieve his vehicle. Before Myers left, Walter threatened to kill him if he ever told anybody what he had seen or done. In summary, an African-American man planning a robbery murder in the heart of Monroeville in the middle of the day stops at a gas station and randomly selects a white man to become his accomplice by asking him to drive him to and from the crime scene because his arm is injured, even though he had been able to drive himself to the gas station where he encountered Myers and to drive his truck home after returning Myers to the gas station. Law enforcement officers knew that Myers' story would be very difficult to prove, so they arrested Walter for sodomy, which served to shock the community and further demonize McMillan. It also gave police an opportunity to bring Walter's truck to the jail for Bill Hooks, a jailhouse informant, to see. Bill Hooks was a young black man with a reputation as a jailhouse snitch. He had been in the county jail for several days on burglary charges when McMillan was arrested. Hooks was promised release from jail and reward money if he could connect McMillan's truck to the Morrison murder. Hooks eagerly told investigators that he had driven by Jackson Cleaners near the time of the crime and had seen a truck tear away from the cleaners with two men inside. At the jail, Hooks positively identified Walter's truck as the one he'd seen at the cleaners nearly 6 months earlier. This second witness gave law enforcement officials what they needed to charge Walter McMillan with capital murder and the shooting death of Rhonda Morrison. When the indictment was announced, there was joy and relief in the community that someone had been charged. Sheriff Tate, the district attorney, and other law enforcement officers who had become targets of criticism were cheered. The absence of an arrest had disrupted life in Monroeville, and now things could settle down. People who knew Walter found it difficult to believe he could be responsible for a sensational murder. He had no history of crime or violence, and for most folks who knew him, robbery just didn't make sense for a man who worked as hard as Walter. Black residents told Sheriff Tate that he had arrested the wrong man. Tate still had not investigated McMillan himself, his life or background, or even his whereabouts on the day of the murder. He knew about the affair with Karen Kelly and had heard the suspicion and rumors that Walter's independence must mean he was dealing drugs. Given his eagerness to make an arrest, This seemed to be enough for Tate to accept Meyer's accusations. As it turned out, on the day of the murder, a fish fry was held at Walter's house. Members of Walter's family spent the day out in front of the house selling food to passersby. Evelyn Smith, Walter's sister, was a local minister, and she and her family occasionally raised money for the church by selling food on the roadside. Because Walter's house was closer to the main road, they often sold from his front yard. There were at least a dozen church parishioners at the house all morning with Walter and his family on the day Rhonda Morrison was murdered. Walter didn't have a tree job that day. He had decided to replace the transmission in his truck and called over his mechanic friend, Jimmy Hunter, to help. By 9:30 in the morning, the two men had dismantled Walter's truck, completely removing the transmission. By 11 o'clock, relatives had arrived and had started frying fish and other food to sell. Some church members didn't get there until later. "Sister, we would have been here long ago, but the traffic in Monroeville was completely backed up. Cop cars and fire trucks looked like something bad happened up at that cleaner's," Evelyn Smith recalled one of the members saying. Police reported that the Morrison murder took place around 10:15 a.m., 11 miles or so from McMillan's home, at the same time that a dozen church members were at Walter's home selling food while Walter and Jimmy worked on his truck. In the early afternoon, Ernest Welch, a white man whom black residents called the furniture man because he worked for a local furniture store, arrived to collect money from Walter's mother for a purchase she had made on credit. Welch told the folks gathered at the house that his niece had been murdered at Jackson Cleaner's that morning. They discussed the shocking news with Welch for some time. Taking into account the church members, Walter's family, and the people who were constantly stopping at the house to buy sandwiches, dozens of people were able to confirm that Walter could not have committed the murder. That group included a police officer who stopped by the house to buy a sandwich and noted in his police log that he had bought food at McMillan's house with Walter and a crowd of church folks present. Based on their personal knowledge of Walter's whereabouts at the time of the Morrison murder, family members, church members, black pastors, and others all pleaded with Sheriff Tate to release McMillan. Tate wouldn't do it. The arrest had been too long in the making to admit yet another failure. After some discussion, the district attorney, the sheriff, and the ABI investigator agreed to stick with the McMillan accusation. Walter's alibi wasn't the only problem for law enforcement. Ralph Myers began to have second thoughts about his allegations against McMillan. He was also facing indictment in the Morrison murder. He'd been promised that he wouldn't get the death penalty and would get favorable treatment in exchange for his testimony, but it was starting to dawn on him that admitting to involvement in a high-profile murder that he actually had nothing to do with was probably not smart. A few days before the capital murder charges against McMillan were made public, Myers summoned police investigators and told them his allegations against McMillan weren't true. At this point, Tate and his investigators had little interest in Myers' recantation. Instead, they decided to pressure Myers to produce more incriminating details. When Myers protested that he didn't have more incriminating details because, well, the story wasn't true, the investigators weren't having it. It's not clear who decided to put both Myers and McMillan on death row before trial to create additional pressure, but it was nearly an unprecedented maneuver that proved very effective. It is illegal to subject pretrial detainees like Walter and Myers to confinement that constitutes punishment. Pretrial detainees are generally housed in local jails, where they enjoy more privileges and more latitude than convicted criminals who are sent to prison. Putting someone who has not yet been tried in a prison reserved for convicted felons is almost never done, as is putting someone not yet convicted of a crime on death row. Even the other death row prisoners were shocked. Death row is the most restrictive punitive confinement permitted. Prisoners are locked in a small cell by themselves for 23 hours a day. Condemned inmates have limited opportunity for exercise or visitation and are held in disturbingly close proximity to the electric chair. Sheriff Tate drove Walter to Holman Correctional Facility, a short ride away in Atmore, Alabama. Before the trip, the sheriff again threatened Walter with racial slurs and terrifying plans. It's unclear how Tate was able to persuade Holman's warden to house two pretrial detainees on death row, although Tate knew people at the prison from his days as a probation officer. The transfer of Myers and McMillan from the county jail to death row took place on August 1, 1987, less than a month before the scheduled execution of Wayne Ritter. When Walter McMillan arrived on Alabama's death row, just 10 years after the modern death penalty was reinstituted, an entire community of condemned men awaited him. Most of the 100 or so death row prisoners who had been sentenced to execution in Alabama since capital punishment was restored in 1975 were black, although to Walter's surprise, nearly 40% of them were white. Everyone was poor, and everyone asked him why he was there. Condemned prisoners on Alabama's death row unit are housed in windowless, concrete buildings that are notoriously hot and uncomfortable. Each death row inmate was placed in a 5-by-8-foot cell with a metal door, a commode, and a steel bunk. The temperatures in August consistently reached over 100 degrees for days, and sometimes weeks at a time. Incarcerated men would trap rats, poisonous spiders, and snakes they found inside the prison to pass the time and to keep safe. Isolated and remote, most prisoners got few visits and even fewer privileges. Existence at Holman centered on Alabama's electric chair. The large wooden chair was built in the 1930s, and inmates had painted it yellow before attaching its leather straps and electrodes. They called it Yellow Mama. The executions at Holman resumed just a few years before Walter arrived. John Evans and Arthur Jones had recently been electrocuted in Holman's execution chamber. Russ Cannon, an attorney with the Southern Prisoners Defense Committee in Atlanta, had volunteered to represent Evans. Evans filmed what became an after-school special for kids where he shared the story of his life with schoolchildren and urged them to avoid the mistakes he had made. After courts refused to block the Evans execution, following multiple appeals, Cannon went to the prison to witness the execution at Evans' request. It was worse than Russ could have ever imagined. He later filed a much-reviewed affidavit describing the entire horrific process. At 8:30 p.m., the first jolt of 1,900 volts of electricity passed through Mr. Evans' body. It lasted 30 seconds. Sparks and flames erupted from the electrode tied to Mr. Evans' left leg. His body slammed against the straps holding him in the electric chair, and his fist clenched permanently. The electrode apparently burst from the strap holding it in place. A large puff of grayish smoke and sparks poured out from under the hood that covered Mr. Evans' face. An overpowering stench of burnt flesh and clothing began pervading the witness room. Two doctors examined Mr. Evans and declared that he was not dead. The electrode on the left leg was refastened. A few minutes later, Mr. Evans was administered a second 30-second jolt of electricity. The stench of burning flesh was nauseating. More smoke emanated from his leg and head. Again, the doctors examined Mr. Evans. The doctors reported that his heart was still beating and that he was still alive. At that time, I asked the prison commissioner who was communicating on an open telephone line to Governor George Wallace to grant clemency on the grounds that Mr. Evans was being subjected to cruel and unusual punishment. The request for clemency was denied. At 8:40 p.m., a third charge of electricity, 30 seconds in duration, was passed through Mr. Evans' body. At 8:44, the doctors pronounced him dead. The execution of John Evans took 14 minutes. Walter McMillan knew nothing about any of this before he arrived at Holman. But with another scheduled execution fast approaching, condemned prisoners were talking about the electric chair constantly when Walter arrived. For his first 3 weeks on Alabama's death row, the horrific execution of John Evans was pretty much all he heard about. The surreal whirlwind of the preceding weeks had left Walter devastated. After living his whole life free and unrestrained by anyone or anything, he found himself confined and threatened in a way he could never have imagined. The intense rage of the arresting officers and the racist taunts and threats from uniformed police officers who did not know him were shocking. He saw in the people who arrested him and processed him at the courthouse, even in other inmates at the jail, a contempt that he'd never experienced before. He'd always been well-liked and gotten along with just about everybody. He genuinely believed the accusations against him had been a serious misunderstanding, and that once officials talked to his family to confirm his alibi, he'd be released in a couple of days. When the days turned into weeks, Walter began to sink into a deep despair. His family assured him that the police would soon let him go, but nothing happened. His body reacted to the shock of his situation. A lifelong smoker, Walter tried to smoke to calm his nerves, but at home he found the experience of smoking nauseating, and he quit immediately. For days he couldn't taste anything he ate. He couldn't orient or calm himself. When he woke each morning, he would feel normal for a few minutes and then sink into terror upon remembering where he was. Prison officials had shaved his head and all the hair from his face. Looking in a mirror, he didn't recognize himself. The county jails where Walter had been housed before his transfer were awful, but the small, hot prison cell on Holman's Death Row was far worse. He was used to working outside among the trees with the scent of fresh pine on the cool breeze. Now he found himself staring at the bleak walls of Death Row. Fear and anguish unlike anything he'd ever experienced settled on Walter. Death Row prisoners were constantly advising him, but he had no way of knowing whom to believe. The judge had earlier appointed an attorney to represent him, a white man Walter didn't trust. His family raised money to hire the only black criminal lawyers in the region, J.L. Chestnut and Bruce Boynton from Selma. Chestnut was fiery and had done a lot of work in the black community to enforce civil rights. Boynton's mother, Amelia Boynton Robinson, was a legendary activist. Boynton himself had strong civil rights credentials as well. Despite their collective experience, Chestnut and Boynton failed to persuade local officials to release Walter and couldn't prevent his transfer to Holman. If anything, hiring outside lawyers seemed to provoke Monroe County officials even more. On the trip to Holman, Tate was furious that McMillan had involved outside counsel. He mocked Walter for thinking it would make any difference. Although the money to hire Chestnut and Boynton was raised by family members through church donations and by pawning their meager possessions, local law enforcement interpreted it as evidence of Walter's secret money hoard and double life, confirmation that he wasn't the innocent black man he pretended to be. Walter tried to adjust to Holman, but things only got worse. With a scheduled execution approaching, people on the row were agitated and angry. Other prisoners had advised him to take action and file a federal complaint since he couldn't legally be held on death row. When Walter, who could barely read or write, failed to file the various pleadings, writs, motions, and lawsuits the other prisoners had advised him to file, they blamed him for his predicament. "Fight for yourself. Don't trust your lawyer. They can't put you on death row without being convicted." Walter heard this constantly, but he couldn't imagine how to file a pleading in court himself. "There were days when I couldn't breathe," Walter recalled later. "I hadn't ever experienced anything like this before in my life. I was around all these murderers, and yet it felt like sometimes they were the only ones trying to help me. I prayed, I read the Bible. I'd be lying if I didn't tell you that I was scared, terrified just about every day." Ralph Myers was faring no better. He had also been charged with capital murder in the death of Rhonda Morrison, and his refusal to continue cooperating with law enforcement meant that he was sent to death row too. He was placed on a different tier to prevent contact with McMillan. Whatever advantage Myers thought he could gain by saying he knew something about the Morrison murder was clearly gone now. He was depressed and sinking deeper into an emotional crisis. From the time he was burned as a child, he had always feared fire, heat, and small spaces. As the prisoners talked more and more about the details of the Evans execution and Wayne Ritter's impending execution, Myers became more and more distraught. On the night of the Ritter execution, Myers was in full crisis, sobbing in his cell. There is a tradition on death row in Alabama that at the time scheduled for the execution, The condemned prisoners bang on their cell doors with cups in protest. At midnight, while all the other prisoners banged away, Myers curled up on the floor in the corner of his cell, hyperventilating and flinching with each clang he heard. When the stench of burned flesh that many on the row claimed they could smell during the execution wafted into his cell, Myers dissolved. He called Tate the next morning and told him that he would say whatever he wanted if he would get him off death row. Tate initially justified keeping Myers and McMillan on death row for safety reasons, but Tate immediately picked Myers up and brought him back to the county jail the day after the Ritter execution. Tate didn't appear to discuss with anyone the decision to move Myers off death row. Ordinarily, the Alabama Department of Corrections couldn't just put people on death row or let them off without court orders or legal filings, and certainly no prison warden could do so on his own. But nothing about the prosecution of Walter McMillan was turning out to be ordinary. Once removed from death row and back in Monroe County, Myers affirmed his initial accusations against McMillan. With Myers back as the primary witness and Bill Hooks ready to say that he saw Walter's truck at the crime scene, the district attorney believed that he could proceed against McMillan. The case was scheduled for trial in February 1988. Ted Pearson had been the district attorney for nearly 20 years. He and his family had lived in South Alabama for generations. He knew the local customs, values, and traditions well, and he had put them to good use in the courtroom. He was getting older and had plans to retire soon, but he hated that his office had been criticized for failing to solve the Morrison murder more quickly. Pearson was determined to leave office with a victory, and likely saw the prosecution of Walt McMillan as one of the most important cases of his career. In 1987, all 40 elected district attorneys in Alabama were white, even though there are 16 majority black counties in the state. When African Americans began to exercise their right to vote in the 1970s, there was deep concern among some prosecutors and judges about how the racial demographics in some counties would complicate their reelections. Legislators had aligned counties to maintain white majorities for judicial circuits that included a majority black county. Still, Pearson had to be more mindful of the concerns of black residents than at the beginning of his career, even if that mindfulness didn't translate into any substantive changes during his tenure. Like Tate, Pearson had heard from many black residents that they believed Walter McMillan was innocent. But Pearson was confident he could win a guilty verdict despite the suspect testimony of Ralph Myers and Bill Hooks and the strong doubts in the black community. His one lingering concern may have been a recent United States Supreme Court case that threatened a long-standing feature of high-profile criminal trials in the South, the all-white jury. When a serious felony case went to trial in a county like Monroe County, which was 40% black, it was not uncommon for prosecutors to exclude all African Americans from jury service. In fact, 20 years after the Civil Rights Revolution, the jury remained an institution largely unchanged by the legal requirements of racial integration and diversity. As far back as the 1880s, the Supreme Court ruled in Strouder v. West Virginia that excluding black people from jury service was unconstitutional, but juries remained all white for decades afterward. In 1945, the Supreme Court upheld a Texas statute that limited the number of black jurors to exactly one per case. In Deep South states, jury rolls were pulled from voting rolls, which excluded African Americans. After the Voting Rights Act passed, court clerks and judges still kept the jury rolls mostly white through various tactics designed to undermine the law. Local jury commissions used statutory requirements that jurors be intelligent and upright to exclude African Americans and women. In the 1970s, the Supreme Court ruled that underrepresentation of racial minorities and women in jury pools was unconstitutional, which in some communities at least led to black people being summoned to the courthouse for possible selection as jurors, if not selected. The court had repeatedly made clear, though, that the Constitution does not require that racial minorities and women actually serve on juries. It only forbids excluding jurors on the basis of race or gender. For many African Americans, the use of wholly discretionary peremptory strikes to select a jury of 12 remained a serious barrier to serving on a jury. In the mid-1960s, the court held that using peremptory strikes in a racially discriminatory manner was unconstitutional, but the justices created an evidentiary standard for proving racial bias that was so high that no one had successfully challenged peremptory strikes in 20 years. The practice of striking all or almost all African-American potential jurors continued virtually unchanged after the court's ruling. So, defendants like Walter McMillan, even in counties that were 40 or 50% black, frequently found themselves staring at all-white juries, especially in death penalty cases. Then in 1986, the Supreme Court ruled in Batson v. Kentucky that prosecutors could be challenged more directly about using peremptory strikes in a racially discriminatory manner, giving hope to black defendants and forcing prosecutors to find more creative ways to exclude black jurors. Walter was learning some of this history as the months passed. Everyone on death row wanted to advise him, and everyone had a story to tell. The novelty of a pretrial capital defendant on death row seemed to motivate other prisoners to get in Walter's ear every day. Walter tried to listen politely, but he'd already decided to leave the lawyering to his lawyers. That didn't mean he wasn't very concerned about what he was hearing from folks on the row, especially about race and the kind of jury he would get. Nearly everyone on death row had been tried by an all-white or nearly all-white jury. Death row prisoner Jesse Morrison told Walter that his prosecutor in Barber County had used 21 out of 22 peremptory strikes to exclude all the black people in the jury pool. Vernon Madison from Mobile said the prosecutor struck all 10 black people qualified for jury service in his case. Willie Tabb from Lamar County, Willie Williams from Houston County, Claude Rains from Jefferson County, Gregory Akers from Montgomery County, and Neil Owens from Russell County were among the many black men on death row who had been tried by all-white juries after prosecutors struck all of the African-American prospective jurors. Earl McGahee was tried by an all-white jury in Dallas County, even though the county is 60% African-American. In Albert Jefferson's case, the prosecutor had organized the list of prospective jurors summoned to court into four groups of roughly 25 people each, identified as strong, medium, weak, and black. All 26 black people in the jury pool could be found on the black list, and the prosecutors excluded them all. Joe Duncan, Grady Bankhead, and Colin Guthrie were among some of the white condemned prisoners who told a similar story. District Attorney Ted Pearson had to be concerned about the new Batson decision. He knew veteran civil rights lawyers like Chestnut and Boynton would not hesitate to object to racially discriminatory jury selection, even though he wasn't too worried about Judge Robert E. Lee Key taking those objections seriously. But the extraordinary publicity surrounding the Morrison murder gave Pearson another idea. In high-profile cases, it's fairly standard for defense lawyers to file a motion to change venue, to move the case from the county where the crime took place to a different county where there is less pretrial publicity and sentiment to convict. The motions are almost never granted, but every now and then an appellate court finds that the atmosphere in a county had been so prejudicial that the trial should have been moved. In Alabama, asking to change venue was an essentially futile act. Alabama courts had almost never reversed a conviction because the trial judge had refused to change venue. When the court scheduled a hearing in October 1987 on pretrial motions in Walter's case, Chestnut and Boynton showed up with no expectation that any of their motions would be granted. They were more focused on preparing for trial, which was scheduled to begin in February 1988. The pretrial motion hearing was a formality. Chestnut and Boynton presented their change of venue motion. Pearson stood up and said that due to the extraordinary pretrial coverage of the Morrison murder, he agreed that the trial should be moved. Judge Key nodded sympathetically. Chestnut, who knew his way around the Alabama courts, was sure something bad was about to happen. He was also certain the judge and the DA had already conspired. "The defendant's motion to change venue is granted," the judge ruled. When the judge suggested that it be moved to a neighboring county so that witnesses wouldn't have far to travel, Chestnut remained hopeful. Almost all of the bordering counties had fairly large African-American populations. Wilcox County was 72% black, Conecuh County was 46% black, Clark County was 45% black, Butler County 42%, Escambia was 32% black. Only affluent Baldwin County to the south, with its beautiful Gulf of Mexico beaches, was atypical, with an African-American population of just 9%. The judge took very little time deciding where the trial should be moved. "We'll go to Baldwin County." Chestnut and Boynton immediately complained, but the judge reminded them it was their motion. When they sought to withdraw the motion, the judge said he couldn't authorize a trial in a community where so many people had formed opinions about the accused. The case would be tried in Bay Minette, the seat of Baldwin County. The change of venue was disastrous for Walter. Chestnut and Boynton knew there would be very few, if any, black jurors. They also understood that while jurors from Baldwin County might be less personally connected to Rhonda Morrison and her family, it was an extremely conservative county that had made even less progress leaving behind the racial politics of Jim Crow than its neighbors. Given what he'd heard from other death row prisoners about all-white juries, Walter worried about the venue change as well. But he still put his faith in this fact. No one could hear the evidence and believe that he committed this crime. He just didn't believe that a jury, black or white, could convict him on the nonsensical story told by Ralph Myers, not when he had an unquestionable alibi with close to a dozen witnesses. The February trial was postponed. Once again, Ralph Myers was having second thoughts. After months in the county jail, away from death row, Myers again realized he didn't want to implicate himself in a murder that he had not committed. He waited until the morning that the trial was set to begin before he told investigators that he could not testify, because what they wanted him to say was not true. He tried to wrangle for more favorable treatment, but decided that there was no punishment he was willing to accept for a murder that he hadn't committed. Myers' refusal to cooperate got him sent back to death row. Back at Holman, it wasn't long before he again showed serious emotional and psychological distress. After a couple of weeks, prison officials were so concerned that they sent him to the state hospital for the mentally ill. The Taylor Hardin Secure Medical Facility in Tuscaloosa did all of the diagnostic and assessment work for courts managing people accused of crimes who might be incompetent to stand trial due to mental illness. It had frequently been criticized by defense lawyers for almost never finding serious mental disabilities that would prevent defendants from going to trial. Myers' time at Taylor Hardin did very little to change his predicament. He hoped that he might be returned to the county jail after his 30-day stint at the hospital, but instead he was returned to death row. Realizing he could not escape the situation he'd created for himself, Myers told investigators he was ready to testify against McMillan. A new trial date was scheduled for August 1988. Walter had been on death row for over a year. As hard as he had tried to adjust, he couldn't accept the nightmare his life had become. Although he was nervous, he'd been convinced that he was going home back in February when the first trial was scheduled. His lawyer seemed happy that Myers was struggling and told Walter it was a good sign when the trial was continued because Myers refused to testify. But it meant another 6 months on death row for Walter, and he couldn't see anything encouraging about that. When they finally moved him to the Baldwin County Jail in Bay Minette for the August trial, Walter left death row confident he'd never return. He had become friends with several men on the row, and he was surprised by how conflicted he felt about leaving them, knowing what they would soon face. Yet when they called his name to the transfer office, he lost no time gathering his things and getting in the van to leave. A week later, Walter sat in the van with shackles pinching his ankles and chains tightly wound around his waist. He could feel his feet beginning to swell because the circulation was cut off by the metal digging into his skin. The handcuffs were too tight, and he was becoming uncharacteristically angry. "Why you got these chains on me this tight?" The two Baldwin County deputies who had picked him up a week earlier had not been friendly on the trip from death row to the courthouse. Now that he had been convicted of capital murder, they were downright hostile. One seemed to laugh in response to Walter's question. "Them chains is the same as they were when we picked you up. They just feel tighter because we got you now. You need to loosen this, man. I can't ride like this. It ain't going to happen, so you should get your mind off it." Walter suddenly recognized the man. At the end of the trial, when the jury had found Walter guilty, his family and several of the black people who had attended the trial were in shocked disbelief. Sheriff Tate claimed that Walter's 24-year-old son, Johnny, said, "Somebody's going to pay for what they've done to my father." Tate asked deputies to arrest Johnny, and there was a scuffle. Walter saw the officers wrestle his child to the ground and place him in handcuffs. The more he looked at the two deputies driving him back to death row, the more convinced he became that one of them had tackled his son. The van began to move. They wouldn't tell Walter where he was going, but as soon as they got on the road, it was clear that they were taking him back to death row. He had been upset and distraught on the day of his arrest, but he was so sure he'd be released soon. He got frustrated when the days turned into weeks at the county jail. He was depressed and terrified when they took him to death row before trial, before being convicted of any crime, and the weeks became months. But when the nearly all-white jury pronounced him guilty, after 15 months of waiting for vindication, he was shocked, paralyzed. Now he felt himself coming back to life, but all he could feel was seething anger. The deputies were driving him back to death row and talking about a gun show they were planning to attend. Walter realized that he had been foolish to give everyone the benefit of the doubt. He knew Tate was vicious and no good, but he assumed that the others were just doing what they'd been told. Now he was feeling something that could only be described as rage. "Hey, I'm going to sue all of y'all!" He knew he was screaming and that it wasn't going to make any difference. "I'm going to sue all of y'all," he repeated. The officers paid him no attention. "Loose these chains! Loose these chains!" He couldn't remember when he'd last lost control, but he felt himself falling apart. With some struggle, he became silent. Thoughts of the trial flew back into his mind. It had been short, methodical, and clinical. Jury selection lasted just a few hours. Pearson used his peremptory strikes to exclude all but one of the handful of African Americans who had been summoned to serve on the jury. His lawyers objected, but the judge summarily dismissed their complaints. The state put Myers on the stand to tell his absurd story about Walter forcing him to drive to Jackson Cleaners because his arm hurt. This version had Myers going into the cleaners, where he saw Walter standing over the dead body of Rhonda Morrison. Bizarrely, he also claimed that a third person was present and involved in the murder, a mysterious white man with salt and pepper hair who was clearly in charge of the crime and who directed Walter to kill Myers too. But Walter couldn't because he was out of bullets. Walter thought the testimony was so nonsensical he couldn't believe that people were taking it seriously. Why wasn't everyone laughing? Chestnut's cross-examination of Myers made it clear that the witness was lying. When Chestnut finished, Walter was sure that the state would simply announce that they had made a mistake. Instead, the prosecutor brought Myers back up to repeat his accusations as if the logic and contradictions in the testimony were completely irrelevant, as if repeating his lies enough times in this quiet room would make them true. Bill Hooks testified that he'd seen Walter's truck pull out of the cleaners at the time of the murder and that he recognized the truck because it had been modified as a lowrider. Walter instantly whispered to his lawyers that he hadn't turned his truck into a lowrider until several months after Morrison was murdered. His lawyers didn't do much with that information, which frustrated Walter. Then another white man Walter had never heard of, Joe Hightower, took the stand and said that he had seen the truck at the cleaners too. There were a dozen people who could talk about the fish fry and insist that Walter was at home when Rhonda Morrison was killed. His lawyers called only three of them. Everybody seemed to be rushing to get the trial over with, and Walter couldn't understand it. The state then called a white man, Ernest Welch, who said he was the furniture man who collected money at the McMillan house on the day they were having a fish fry, but it wasn't the same day that Rhonda Morrison was murdered. He said he remembered better than anyone when she was murdered because he was her uncle. He said that he had been so devastated that he went to the McMillan residence to collect money on a different day. The lawyers made their arguments, the jury retired, and less than 3 hours later, they filed back into the courtroom. Stone-faced, one by one, they pronounced Walter McMillan guilty. Chapter 4. The Old Rugged Cross. In February 1989, Eva Ansley and I opened our new nonprofit law center in Tuscaloosa, dedicated to providing free, quality legal services to condemned men and women on death row in Alabama. We never thought it would be easy, but it turned out to be even harder than we had expected. In the first few months of operation, our first director resigned. The University of Alabama School of Law, where we had set up the office, withdrew their support and promise of office space, and we discovered just how hard it was to find lawyers to come to Alabama and do full-time death penalty work for less than $25,000 a year. Obstacles were multiplying rapidly. We were denied funding from the state legislature, which we needed to get federal matching dollars. After several disheartening meetings with our board, it had become clear that we had no support in the state for the project. State bar leaders were committed to seeing our operation succeed, some because they felt it was unacceptable that condemned prisoners could not obtain legal assistance, others because they wanted more executions at a faster pace, and felt that the absence of counsel was slowing them down. But we now realized that we would have to do it on our own and raise the money ourselves. Eva and I regrouped and decided to start again in Montgomery, the state capital. The project would eventually be named the Equal Justice Initiative, EJI. I found a small building near downtown Montgomery, and in the summer of 1989, we signed a lease. The building was a good start, a rented two-story Greek Revival house built in 1882 near the historic district called Old Alabama Town. It was painted yellow and had a charming porch that made it feel open and welcoming, a nice contrast from the daunting courtrooms, institutional waiting rooms, and prison walls that define so much of the lives of our clients' family members. The office was cold in the winter, it was almost impossible to keep squirrels out of the attic, and there wasn't enough electricity to run the copier and a coffee pot at the same time without blowing a fuse. But from the start, it felt like a home and a place to work, and given the hours we would spend there, it was always a little of both. Eva took on administrative duties for our new project, which were pretty challenging given that federal dollars came with all kinds of complex reporting and accounting requirements. Eva was fearless and smart, and she sorted everything out so that a few dollars could trickle in. We hired a receptionist and tried to figure out how to survive. I had worked on fundraising for the Southern Prisoners Defense Committee almost as soon as I started there, so I had some experience asking for money to support our work. I was sure there would be a way to raise enough for the new Alabama office to meet the minimum federal matching requirements. We just needed some time. Something, as it turned out, we wouldn't get at all. A flood of execution dates awaited us. Between the passage of Alabama's new death penalty statute in 1975 and the end of 1988, there had been only three executions in Alabama. But in 1989, driven by a change in the Supreme Court's treatment of death penalty appeals and shifts in the political winds, the Attorney General's office began vigorously seeking executions of condemned prisoners. By the end of 1989, the number of people executed by the state of Alabama would double. Months before our center opened, I started visiting Alabama's death row every month, traveling from Atlanta to see a handful of new clients, including Walter McMillan. They were all grateful for the help, but as the spring of 1989 approached, they all made the same request at the end of our meetings. Help Michael Lindsay. Lindsay's execution was scheduled for May 1989. Later, they would ask me to help Horace Duncan's, whose execution was scheduled for July 1989. I painfully explained the constraints on resources and time, telling them how frantic we were just trying to get the new office up and running. Although they said they understood, they were clearly anguished about getting legal assistance while other men faced looming executions. Both Lindsay and Duncan's had volunteer lawyers who had reached out to me for help because they were overwhelmed. Lindsay's lawyer, David Bagwell, was a respected civil attorney from Mobile. He had worked on the case of Wayne Ritter, who had been executed a year earlier. That experience left Bagwell disillusioned and angry. He wrote a scathing letter, published in the State Bar Association's journal, in which he vowed never to take another death penalty case, even if they disbar me for my refusal, and urged other civil lawyers not to take death penalty cases. Bagwell's public complaints made it hard for courts to appoint other civil lawyers for last-stage appeals in a death penalty case, not that they were particularly inclined to do so. But it had another effect as well. Prisoners got word of the letter and talked about it among themselves, especially about a chilling comment buried in Bagwell's gerrymade. "I generally favor the death penalty because mad dogs ought to die." The prisoners became even more distrustful of lawyers, even the ones who claimed they would help. After further pleading by our other clients, we decided to do what we could for Michael Lindsay, whose execution date was fast approaching. We tried to make argument about an interesting twist in that case. His jury had never decided that Michael Lindsay should be executed at all. Lindsay received a sentence of life imprisonment without parole from his jury, but the judge had overridden it and imposed a death sentence on his own. Death sentences resulting from judge override were an anomaly, even back in 1989. In almost every state, juries made the decision to impose the death penalty or life in prison without parole. If the jury imposed or rejected death, that was the final judgment. Only Florida and Alabama allowed the jury's decision to be overridden by a judge, and Florida later put restrictions on the practice that severely curtailed it. It remains the law in Alabama, where judges almost exclusively use this power to turn life sentences into death sentences, although they're also authorized to reduce death verdicts to life if they so choose. Since 1976, judges in Alabama have overridden jury sentencing verdicts in capital cases 111 times. In 91% of these cases, judges replaced life verdicts from juries with death sentences. The practice has been further complicated by the increasingly competitive nature of judicial elections in the state. Alabama elects all of its judges in highly competitive, partisan elections, one of only 6 states to do so. 32 states have some form of nonpartisan judicial election process. The elections attract campaign contributions from business interests seeking tort reform, or from trial lawyers who want to protect large civil verdicts. But since most voters are unschooled in these areas, the campaigns invariably focus on crime and punishment. Each judge competes to be the toughest on crime. The people financing these elections are largely unconcerned with whatever modest differences exist between candidates on crime, but punishment gets the votes. Judge overrides are an incredibly potent political tool. No judge wants to deal with attack ads that highlight the grisly details of a murder case in which the judge failed to impose the most severe punishment. Seen in that light, it's not surprising that judge overrides tend to increase in election years. We wrote a letter to the governor of Alabama, Guy Hunt, asking him to stop the Lindsay execution on the grounds that the jury, empowered to pass judgment on him, had decided against putting him to death. Governor Hunt quickly denied our request for clemency, declaring that he would not go against the wishes of the community expressed by the jury that Mr. Lindsay be put to death, even though we stressed that the community's representatives, the jury, had done the opposite. It clearly elected to spare Lindsay's life. It didn't matter. As peculiar as the practice is, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld judicial override in an earlier Florida case, which left us with no constitutional basis to block Michael Lindsay's execution. He was electrocuted on May 26, 1989. Immediately after Lindsay, we were faced with Horace Duncan's execution date. Once again, we tried to help in whatever ways we could, even though time was quickly running out and there was little hope. Mr. Duncan suffered from intellectual disabilities, and the trial judge had found he had mental retardation based on his school records and earlier testing. Just a few months before his execution was scheduled, the Supreme Court upheld the practice of executing the mentally retarded. 13 years later, in Atkins v. Virginia, the court recognized that executing people with intellectual disabilities is cruel and unusual punishment and banned the practice as unconstitutional. For many condemned and disabled people like Horace Duncan's, the ban came too late. The Duncan's family called frequently, trying to figure out what could be done with only days to go before his execution, but there were very few options. When it became clear there was no way to stop the execution, the family turned their attention to what would happen to Mr. Duncan's body after his death. They seemed particularly concerned, for religious reasons, with preventing the state from performing an autopsy on their son's body. The date of the execution arrived, and Horace Duncan's was killed in a botched execution that made national news. Correctional officials had plugged the electrodes into the chair incorrectly, so only a partial electrical charge was delivered to Mr. Duncan's body when the electric chair was activated. After several agonizing minutes, the chair was turned off, but Mr. Duncan's was still alive, unconscious, but breathing. Officials waited several more minutes for the body to cool before realizing that the electrodes had not been connected properly. They made alterations and electrocuted Mr. Duncan's again, and this time it worked. They killed him. Following this cruelly mishandled execution, the state performed an autopsy, against the family's repeated requests. I received a call from Mr. Duncan's distraught father after the execution. He said, "They could take his life, even though he didn't get a fair trial and he didn't deserve that. But they had no right to mess with his body, and soul too. We want to sue them." We provided some aid to the volunteer lawyer on the case, and a suit was filed, although there wasn't much hope. There were a few depositions, but no judgment of relief. The civil suit failed to slow down the state of Alabama, which moved ahead aggressively with more execution dates. We relocated to our new office in Montgomery in the shadow of these two executions. The men on death row were more agitated and unnerved than ever. When Herbert Richardson received word in July that his execution was scheduled for August 18, he called me collect from death row. "Mr. Stevenson, this is Herbert Richardson, and I've just received notice that the state plans to execute me on August 18. I need your help. You can't say no. I know you're helping some of the guys and y'all are opening an office, so please help me." I replied, I'm really sorry to hear about your execution date. It's been a very tough summer. What does your volunteer lawyer say?" I was still working on the best way to talk to condemned people about how to respond to news of an execution date. I wanted to say something reassuring like, "Don't worry," but of course that would be a remarkable request to make of anyone. News of a scheduled execution was nothing if not unimaginably worrisome. "Sorry" didn't seem quite right either, but it tended to be the best I could think of. "I don't have a volunteer lawyer, Mr. Stevenson. I don't have anyone. My volunteer lawyer said he couldn't do any more to help me over a year ago. I need your help." We still didn't have computers or law books, and I didn't have other lawyers on staff. I had hired a classmate of mine from Harvard Law School who agreed to join our staff and move to Alabama from his home in Boston. I was thrilled to finally have some help. He had been in Montgomery for a few days when I had to leave town for a fundraising trip. When I returned, he was gone. He left a note explaining that he didn't realize how challenging it would be for him to live in Alabama. He hadn't been there a week. Trying to stop an execution would mean nonstop work, 18 hours a day for a month, desperately trying to get a stay order from a court. Only an all-out effort would get it done, and it was still wildly improbable that we'd succeed in blocking the execution. When I could think of nothing to fill the silence, Richardson continued, "Mr. Stevenson, I have 30 days. Please say you'll help me." I didn't know what else to do but be truthful. "Mr. Richardson, I'm so sorry, but I don't have books, staff, computers, or anything we need to take on new cases yet. I haven't even hired lawyers. I'm trying to get things set up, but I have an execution date. You have to represent me. What's the point of all of that other stuff if you're not going to help people like me?" I could hear his breath growing ragged. "They're going to kill me," he said. "I know what you're saying, and I'm trying to figure out how to help. We're just so overextended." I didn't know what to say, and a long silence fell between us. I could hear him breathing heavily on the phone, and I could imagine how frustrated he must be. I was bracing myself for him to say something angry or bitter, steeling myself to absorb his understandable rage. But then the phone suddenly went silent. He'd hung up. I was unnerved by the call for the rest of the day and couldn't find sleep that night. I was haunted by my helpless, bureaucratic demurrals in the face of his desperation and the silence of his response. The next day, he called again, to my relief. "Mr. Stevenson, I'm sorry, but you have to represent me. I don't need you to tell me that you can stop this execution. I don't need you to say you can get a stay. But I have 29 days left, and I don't think I can make it if there's no hope at all. Just say you'll do something and let me have some hope." It was impossible for me to say no, so I said yes. "I'm not sure there is anything we can do to block this, given where things are," I told him somberly, "but we'll try. If you could do something, anything, well, I'd be very grateful."